You're listening to a special slot of Hidden Histories with On the Record with Gavin Riley on News Talk, where ordinarily we would be on air at around about 12:30 on a Sunday afternoon. We are not on air today because Off the Ball have live exclusive coverage of Toulouse versus Ulster in the quarterfinals of the Heineken Champions Cup. But instead, Donal Fallon has come in anyway, and we decided we would do a special edition of Hidden Histories one way or another, because today is actually a fairly momentous anniversary. Today is exactly a century since September the 20th, 1920, a day when the town of Balbriggan in North County Dublin, often claimed by Meath, and I can understand why, because it's lovely, was burnt in a vicious reprisal that would send shockwaves throughout the world and actually cause a fair bit of chaos in the British House of Commons as well. The burning of Balbriggan happened at a time when the war in Ireland was spiralling out of control, but few could have predicted the impact that it would have had on domestic British politics or on the hearts of Irish America. And Donal Fallon, as ever, giggling away there in the background, is here to tell us all about it. I'm glad you're giggling, actually, because at least, you know, they say that like time plus tragedy equals comedy.
Yeah.
So at least now, this far removed, you're able to have a good giggle about it. But today, obviously, the centenary of the sacking of Balbriggan, which was one of the more difficult centenaries. But this year, of course, it'll pass remarkably unremarkable.
Yes, that's really, I suppose, as far as commemoration is concerned, the story of the year. These anniversaries are just rolling by. Michael D. Higgins, as we'll come to at the end, has marked the centenary with a very beautiful written piece. But it's worth saying, you know, not all centenaries are celebrations, you know, far from it. And definitely right now is a time when there are a lot of difficult anniversaries coming up in the revolutionary period. You know, a few weeks ago on the slot, we looked at the Hollywood-esque shooting dead of Detective Oswald Swansea on the streets
still
of
Lisburn.
Still not
convinced that's an actual name. There's no way anyone is called Detective Oswald Swansea.
Today we arrive at the burning of Balbriggan. And, you know, one gets a sense, even at the remove of a century, that, you know, life in September 1920 wasn't particularly pleasant on the island of Ireland. But the burning of Balbriggan, or the sack of Balbriggan as contemporaries knew it, would cast a very, very long shadow. And, you know, in one level, it was an act of economic warfare, burning one of the main local employers to the ground and many homes with it. And interestingly, it's one of those events in the War of Independence that never really passed into history, if you know what I mean. I mean, it's still contested. Earlier on this year, the journalist Simon Carswell from the Irish Times went out there and vox-popped people in Balbriggan around the time of kind of RIC Gate.
That was only this year.
This year, God, local so Fine Gael canvassers on the ground in Balbriggan were actually, you know, baffled by the level of emotional reaction, even at the remove of a century, that the burning of Balbriggan was having.
Let's bring us back to the sort of the context, just to sort of catch our bearings where we are. This is a time when Balbriggan was being transformed in a fairly short period from what was ordinarily and previously a very quiet place, and suddenly then became this real centre of revolution.
And as you said in your introduction, you know, often claimed by me, like Balbriggan, it's North County Dublin. It's kind of far removed from the city. It is, in many ways, it was, I should say, more than today. It's kind of suburban today, but it was very rural, you know. And Balbriggan kind of embodied the change that was happening in broader Irish life, because just a few years earlier, basically nothing had happened in Balbriggan. One of the local volunteers, John Gaynor, he said that the town of Balbriggan and the surrounding country was not involved in the rebellion of 1916. There was no unit of the Irish volunteers that I knew of. I don't think there was even anyone arrested from here after the collapse of the Rising. I was only around 16 years old and too young and immature to have taken part. So Balbriggan was the kind of place that the early stages of the Irish Revolution seemed to really pass it by.
Yeah.
And then the thing just goes up. You know, 1918, there's the anti-conscription movement. The fear of being sent off to the war is very real. And the same guy, Gaynor, says, "Never before was there such a unity of purpose in the county. Men now flocked to join the volunteers, and our strength went to over 200 in a brief space of time." So this is all happening very, very quickly when you think about it. And some 2 years after that, after 1918, it's international news. I mean, it's the front of the New York Times, this town, Balbriggan, which presumably no one in the US, bar Irish Americans, had ever heard of before, burnt to the ground by black and tans. An immediate disaster for the British, because think about where Balbriggan is. You know, it's close enough to Dublin City that a photographer could hop on a bicycle and arrive at this town, and those images would make their way across the world.
So again, to put all of this in a little bit more context, obviously this is the immediate aftermath of the Rising, and we have this sort of very painful transition towards independence and the election of 1918 and everything. And by the summer of 1920, therefore, the way in which Ireland was being policed was radically different.
You don't have your little sleepy police stations anymore, you know, the Royal Irish Constabulary station with the thatched roof in rural Ireland, because they were just too easy a target. I mean, the Republicans knew there were weapons, there were guns in those kind of stations. So up and down the island of Ireland, police stations had been burnt and emptied of anything that was not nailed to the ground. So what you have instead is kind of significant, very militarised garrisons of police. I mean, they call themselves police, but they're basically soldiers. And a lot of them have been recruited, you know, to meet the pressing demand from veterans of the war in England. We call them the black and tans because they're just rushed into service. You know, whatever uniforms they could get, those trousers, that jacket, that will do. Mm. Black and tan, out you go. And one of the most significant bases was at Gormanstown, not too far from Balbriggan. Mm. So there's a lot of tremendous local tension. And, you know, forget about a dog licence or forget about if someone burgled your house. The police are gone. As a day-to-day thing in Ireland in 1920, there is no police. There's basically barracks full of soldiers. And you can imagine if you are a policeman, if you're a member of the RIC, the siege mentality must have been very real. Because, I mean, you could look at the election in 1918 and say, that was a fluke. You know, the people went out, they didn't know they were voting for war.
This wasn't sort of secession or whatever.
Exactly.
This was just
But then there were local elections in 1920 and you know, the Sinn Féin vote was actually increased. They got an even greater mandate. So you would have felt, I think, as a policeman in basically a military barracks, that you were uttered, you know, you were disconnected from Irish society. Yeah. And the view of the Irish of the Tans is brilliant. I mean, one contemporary says they had neither religion or morals. They used foul language. They had the old soldier's talent for dodging and scrounging. They spoke in strange accents, called the Irish natives, associated with low company, stole from each other, sneered at the customs of the country, drank to excess and put sugar in their porridge. Now, I don't know.
That's the real mortal sin from everything else that you've done.
If that was genuinely shocking a century ago, or if it's some kind of brilliant metaphor, I don't know. But I mean, these police/soldiers just didn't mingle with the civilian population, and Balbriggan showed exactly why.
What kicked it all off then? Because we still get the impression from your introduction there that Balbriggan was a sleepy enough place where not a huge amount happened. What happens that the whole thing kicks off?
The cold facts of it are that Peter Burke, who's an RIC man, head constable of the RIC, he's shot in Smith's pub, which is still there. It's now the Millrace. He goes in on the 20th of September. And he's refused the drink because publicans are kind of very, very conscious that there's a revolution happening outside. There's a boycott of the police ordered by Dáil Éireann. You're not meant to deal with the police. So when a policeman from the RIC walks into your pub and he orders a pint, you don't really know what to do. But, you know, in the end, these lads are ultimately served and a confrontation follows. Republicans arrive. They hear that he's been served in the pub. Shots are fired. Burke is dead. And word kind of quickly reaches the nearby Gormanstown where you have hundreds of kind of up for it black and tans. And the series of events that followed, I mean, the wholesale destruction of the town's infrastructure and economy was unlike any kind of reprisal that had been witnessed before. They were a new thing, to be honest. The idea that, you know, if you were attacked, you responded by going to the nearest town and causing mayhem. Mm. It was a new thing. And it was very unpopular among kind of British political class in Westminster. Hammer Greenwood said, there's no policy of reprisals in Ireland, but if there is, it's working. You know, which is a good way of putting it.
Wow.
But they're designed to break the morale of the civilian population and they're designed to kind of drive a wedge between civilians and the IRA. In other words, if the IRA stop attacking us, we stop attacking civilians.
Yeah.
But I think ultimately it demonstrates something else, which is the psychological breakdown of Crown forces, that these black and tans were just on edge and it didn't take a whole lot to push them over it. And this wasn't, to be honest, the behaviour of an army, even rebranded as a police force. It was an army who just won a world war. Incredible. You go from winning a war in France and Belgium to burning down sleepy villages in North County Dublin.
Yeah, but anything that which is notionally supposed to be a police force which responds, albeit to, you know, what was fairly grave but still a fairly minor provocation and still ended up then just with the whole town basically been burnt to a ground. It still seems like a fairly gross overreaction to this day anyway, but I can understand why it's so contested. There were some houses torched, but there's still even, and this goes back to your point about how it's never passed into history, to this day there's still a row about whether the houses that were torched were deliberately targeted or not.
Yeah, Clonard Street, which was burned, dozens of families left homeless. Very difficult to believe that's random for me because the street was known locally as kind of Sinn Féin Alley owing to the number of volunteers who lived there. But to be honest, there are volunteers in every, from university lecturers to newspaper sellers on the streets of Dublin. Volunteers were everywhere by this stage. You know, the country was in the midst of a revolution. So you could have burned any random street in Balbriggan and taken the homes of volunteers with you. Mm. But what was more random was just the looting of public houses. And then observers remember like just bizarre behaviour, like just people who have just had total mental breakdowns firing on livestock in fields. And from Dublin Street to Drogheda Street, that's about a mile in length in Balbriggan today. All of it was just in carnage and ablaze.
Just firing in livestock in fields.
Well, it's economic war when you think about it. People are dependent on livestock.
Well, I suppose that's if you think about it as being an agrarian economy back in 1920, it makes a little bit more sense. Just now when you talk about firing at livestock, it just seems more like one of those sort of Geordie soccer fans who just goes around punching a horse with no apparent, you know, rhyme or reason for it. Obviously then, aside from there being sort of grave damage to people's homes, local employment was completely devastated.
For whatever reason, and no one's ever adequately explained this to me, and if someone from Balbriggan knows the answer, I'd love to know why this is, but Balbriggan was home to a very significant hosiery factory. One of them, Deeds, Templar and Company, which was torched, and then Messrs. Smith and Company. They actually provided the stockings for Queen Victoria herself, no less. But I mean, the first of those companies was very British in outlook. It was controlled by London money. That counted for nothing. You know, grenades were just tossed into it, but its hands was destroyed by the inferno. And then most significantly, two local men are killed. Seamus Lawless, who's the local barber, and a dairy farmer called Sean Gibbons. And they're both volunteers. But anyone who kind of knows Balbriggan will notice that there's a plaque to them on Bridge Street. You know, popular local characters, and their deaths were definitely not random.
No, it's wild actually that point you make about how even Queen, the people who made Queen Victoria's stockings, that they're the ones who are done. That it doesn't seem to be a huge amount of rhyme or reason even then, that they just decided that even possibly the most British people in the place would still not be able to escape the whole thing. All of this, predictably enough, then begins something of a propaganda or a press war. And actually what's remarkable is that even not everyone within the Black and Tans is happy about how they handle it.
Yeah, I mean, the reproduction of images is still a new thing. You know, the 19th century, even into the early 20s, the Illustrated London News, people were used to seeing drawn depictions of things, but actual pictures of, you know, this destroyed town in North County Dublin go around the world. And then you have this guy, Alfred Flint, who's a disillusioned ex-Black and Tan, or so he claims, and he's interviewed in the Freeman's Journal. He says, "I put in my resignation after Balbriggan. They asked for my reason. I told them that when I joined, I thought I was going into a police force, but it looks as if I went into a corps of bandits." Mm. Now, definitely some people did leave the Tans, horrified by the events, but I think, you know, they were the exception and not the rule.
Yeah, and then, of course, as you mentioned, because Balbriggan is in this very delicate spot where it's possible for press photographers to cycle out and get the pictures of it, it dominates the international press, and then it ends up going home in a way to Westminster as well.
Asquith, you know, the former Prime Minister, he compares Balbriggan and the House of Commons to towns that are destroyed by Germany in the war. The Labour Party start demanding an independent inquiry. Arthur Henderson, amazing guy, is the leader of the Labour Party three different times in three different decades. Arthur Henderson says Britain is pursuing a policy of military terrorism, which is not only a betrayal of democratic principles, but totally opposed to the best traditions of the British people. And interestingly, I mean, the point was made on Twitter this morning that even Conservatives, even people in the Conservative Party come out and say this is not the British way of doing war. So I think what the event did reveal was the cracks, if you know what I mean, in the morale of the British. And one British senior official tried to justify it, and he said, you know, worse things can happen than the firing up of a sink like Balbriggan. But I don't think he could have known that sink, so to speak, would make its way to the New York Times, you know, and beyond. You had the American Commission on Conditions in Ireland established. You know, senior Republican and Democratic politicians in America start taking an interest in what's happening in Ireland. Some of them even visit Ireland and they stand in the ruins of Balbriggan. So, you know, Balbriggan is the moment, I think, when the British were losing not only the Irish public, but the American public, and, you know, even some sections of the British public as well.
It's remarkable, actually, when you put the whole thing in context and you think about these lads who were in this barracks, who were basically kind of hemmed in, cloistered, really very much made to feel like the unwelcome, you know, occupying military power that most people probably thought they were, that they began to see themselves as that. And then some of them clearly just went a little bit postal as a result. And that's what sort of resulted in this mass event that really didn't need to have happened otherwise.
The psychology of war and the mental breakdown of soldiers, you know, it's always, always interesting. I think that's what Balbriggan is all about.
You mentioned that there's a statement this morning from Uachtaráin Héireann about it as well.
Yeah, and not an easy morning to be Michael D. Higgins. I have great sympathy for Michael D. today. It's a horrible thing to lose a pet, and not least in this time, you know, when you're spending so much time at home. But Michael D. penned a really beautiful statement on the centenary, which was probably intended to be a speech, you know, in better times. And there's so much of substance in it, as there always is in the reflections of Michael D. And he talks about, you know, the harshness of the time, memory, meaning, the need to acknowledge events like Balbriggan, even though they might make us uncomfortable, that are part of the narrative but can't be ignored. But ultimately, the note that he struck in so much of the decade of centenaries, you know, it's philosophical, looking forwards as well as back. He wrote that forgiving, therefore, enables us to come to terms with the past. If forgiveness and forgetting did not exist, we'd be trapped in the past, where every previous action would be irrevocable, and where the present is dominated, burdened even, by preceding events and memories. But recognition of the act committed is essential. Wonderful words from Michael Dean.
And very sensitive and very meditated on as well. But I suppose just to go back to the very, very start, when Simon Carswell went out in the middle of RIC Gate, which unthinkably was only about 8.5 months ago. What a crazy year this has been. But that it's funny that clearly there hasn't been an awful lot of necessarily forgiving or forgetting, because out there it's still the thing that's still, you know, ingrained into everyone's collective memory.
The families of the two men killed, you know, they were interviewed in the newspapers today, they're still there. So it takes a long time in Ireland for the past to become history.
Extraordinary stuff. Donal, thank you as ever for coming in, and glad that we're able to put this out as a podcast even for the day that's in it, even though we're not on air today. Donal Fallon, as ever, is a historian. He's the author of the Come Here to Me books, and he's the presenter of the Three Castles Burning podcast. And if you enjoyed this little snippet of Donal's sort of contributions to the show, don't forget you'll hear him every Sunday when we're back at our usual length, 11 to 1, just a little bit after 12:30 every Sunday afternoon.